as yellow due to his great age, filmed over with a sort of glassy gleam. His whole face instantly took on the ashen boniness of a skeleton's head. His arms fell, dangling as though a spring in them had broken, and his stupor expressed itself in the way he spread the fingers of his two badly shaking old hands. His knees buckled forward, showing his poor bare legs bristling with white hairs through the gap in his dressing gown, and he murmured, "Marius." "Monsieur," said Basque, "they have just brought Monsieur home. He was at the barricade and—"
"He's dead," cried the old man in a terrible voice. "Ah, the rascal!"
Then a sort of sepulchral transfiguration made this centenarian stand as tall and erect as a young man.
"Monsieur," he said, "you are the doctor. Begin by telling me one thing. He is dead, isn't he?"
The doctor, in a paroxysm of anxiety, remained silent. Monsieur Gillenormand wrung his hands with a frightening burst of laughter.
"He's dead! He's dead! He got himself killed at the barricades, out of hatred for me. It's to spite me that he did that. Ah, bloodsucker! This is the way he comes back to me. Misery of my life! He's dead!"
He went to the window, flung it open wide as though he was suffocating, and, standing facing the darkness, he started talking to the night out there in the street.
"Riddled with holes, sabred, butchered, exterminated, hacked to pieces, carved up. You see that? The little rogue. He knew very well that I was waiting for him, and that I had them fix up his room, and that I had them hang his portrait from when he was a little boy by my bed. He knew very well that he only had to come back, and that I'd been calling him back for years, and that I spent every night in my corner by the fire, with my hands on my knees, not knowing what to do, losing my mind, worrying about him. You knew all that very well, and that you only had to come home and say it's me, and you'd be master of the house, and that I'd do whatever you said, and that you could do whatever you liked with your old codger of a grandfather. You knew that very well, and you said, 'No, he's a royalist, I won't go,' and off you went to the barricades, and you got yourself killed out of spite to get revenge for what I said to you about Monsieur le Duc de Berry. That's what's so despicable. Go to bed, then, and sleep soundly. He is dead. That's what I've got to wake up to.'"
The doctor, who was beginning to worry on both scores, left Marius for a moment and went over to Monsieur Gillenormand and took his arm. The grandfather spun round, looked at him with widened, bloodshot eyes, and said to him calmly,
"Monsieur, I thank you, I am calm. I am a man. I saw the death of Louis XVI. I know how to bear up under events. There is one thing that is terrible, though, and that is to think that it is your newspapers that do all the damage. You can have all the scribblers, gas-bags, lawyers, orators, tribunes, debates, progress, enlightenment, rights of man, freedom of the press you want, and this is how they bring your children back home for you. Ah, Marius, it's abominable. Killed, dead before me. A barricade. Ah, the little cur. Doctor, you live in the neighborhood, I believe. Oh, I know you well. I see your cabriolet going by from my window. Let me tell you something. You'd be mistaken to think I'm angry. One does not get angry at a dead man. That would be stupid. I raised this child, you see. I was already old when he was still only a toddler. He used to play in the Tuileries with his little spade and his little chair, and so the keepers would not scold him. I'd get my cane and fill in the holes he made in the ground with his spade as he made them. One day he yelled, 'Down with Louis XVIII,' and off he went. It's not my fault. He was all rosy and blonde. His mother is dead. Have you noticed how all little children are blonde? Where does that come from? He is the son of one of those brigands of the Loire. But children are innocent of the crimes of their fathers. I remember when he was just this high, he could never manage to pronounce the D's. He chattered away so sweetly and so unintelligibly, you'd have thought he was a bird. I remember once in front of the Farnese Hercules, they all stood around in a circle to marvel at him and admire him. He was so beautiful, that child. He had a head like the ones in paintings. I put on my gruff voice for him. I frightened him with my cane, but he knew very well that it was all just in fun. In the morning, when he used to come into my room, I would growl at him, but for me it was like sunshine streaming in. You can't defend yourself against these little mites. They take hold of you, they hold on to you, they never let go of you. The truth is that there never was a little love like that child there. Now, What do you have to say for your Lafayettes, your Benjamin Constants, and your Tirqueur de Courcelles that have gone and killed him for me? It can't go on like this."
He went over to Marius, still livid and motionless, the doctor once more by his side, and he began to wring his hands again. The white lips of the old man moved as though they had a will of their own, and let slip, like the exhalations of a death rattle, almost indistinct words that could barely be heard.
"Ah, heartless! Ah, clubbist! Ah, scoundrel! Ah, Septembrist!"
Reproaches made tonelessly by a dying man to a corpse. Little by little, as inner eruptions will always out, he strung his words together again in a sequence, but the grandfather appeared to have no strength left to utter them. His voice was so subdued and faint that it seemed to come from the other side of an abyss.
"I don't care. I'll die too, I will. And don't tell me that in all Paris there wasn't some little vixen who'd have been glad to make this miserable wretch happy. A young rascal who, instead of having fun and enjoying life, took himself off to fight and got himself shot to bits like a noodle. And who for? What for? For the Republic. Instead of going dancing at the Chaumière, as young people are supposed to. What's the good of being 20 years old, I ask you? The Republic, what a load of poppycock. Poor mothers. Go and make pretty boys, why don't you? So that's that. He's dead. That'll be 2 graves under the porte cochere. So this is how you spruce yourself up for the fine eyes of this General Lamarque, a sword slinger, a blatherskite. Fancy getting yourself killed for a dead man. If that isn't enough to drive a man mad, go and figure that out. At 20 years old, and without turning a hair to see if he was leaving someone behind. So now we poor old blighters are forced to die all alone. Croak in your corner, old owl. Well, then, actually, so much the better. It's what I was hoping for. It will kill me stone dead. I'm too old. I'm 100 years old. I'm 100,000 years old. I earned the right to be dead long ago. This blow will do the trick. So it's over. What luck! What's the good of making him sniff ammonia and all these other drugs? You're wasting your time, you numbskull of a quack. Get out of there. He's dead, dead as a doornail. Take it from me. I'm one who knows. I'm dead, too. He hasn't done it by halves. Yes, these are ghastly times, ghastly, ghastly. And here is what I think of you, of your ideas, of your systems, of your masters, of your oracles, of your doctors, of your little pipsqueaks of writers, of your weasels of philosophers, and of all the revolutions that have terrified the flocks of crows in the Tuileries for the last 60 years. And since you showed no mercy in getting yourself killed like this, I won't even feel any grief at your death. Do you hear? You assassin.
At that moment, Marius's eyelids slowly lifted, and his eyes, still filmy with drowsy amazement, rested on Monsieur Gillenormand.
"Marius!" cried the old man.
"Marius! My darling Marius! My dear boy! My beloved son! You've opened your eyes! You are looking at me! You are alive! Thank you!"
And he promptly passed out. Book 4. Javert derailed. Javert had walked away from the Rue de l'Homme Armé with slow tread. He walked with his head down for the first time in his life, and also for the first time in his life with his hands behind his back. Until that day, Javert had only ever adopted of Napoleon's two poses, the one that expresses resolution, arms folded over the chest, the one that expresses uncertainty, hands behind the back, was unknown to him. Now a change had occurred. His whole person, slow and somber, was stamped with anxiety. He plunged into the silent streets, yet he was headed in only one direction. He took a shortcut to the Seine, reached the Quai des Ormes, followed the quay, passed La Grève, and stopped at some distance from the Place du Châtelet guardhouse, at the corner of the Pont Notre-Dame. There, between the Pont Notre-Dame and the Pont au Change, on the one hand, and between the Quai de la Magistrie and the Quai aux Fleurs on the other, the Seine forms a sort of squared-off lake, crossed by a rapid. This point of the Seine is dreaded by bargemen. Nothing is more dangerous than this rapid, confined in those days and churned up by the piles of the bridge mill since demolished. The two bridges, being so close to each other, increase the peril. The water rushes mightily under the arches. It rolls there in wide and terrible corrugations. It gathers and builds. The torrent charges at the piles of the bridges as though to rip them out with fat liquid ropes. Men who fall in there never reappear. The best swimmers drown. Javert leaned on the parapet with both elbows, his chin in both hands, and while his nails mechanically raked through his thick sideburns, he reflected. A new thing, a revolution, a catastrophe had just taken place deep inside him, and he had good grounds for examining himself. Javert was in appalling pain. For some hours now, Javert had stopped being a simple man. He was deeply troubled. That brain, so limpid in its blindness, had lost its transparency. There was a cloud in the crystal. Javert felt duty splitting in two in his conscience, and he could not dodge the fact. When he had run into Jean Valjean so unexpectedly on the bank of the Seine, he had felt something like a wolf catching its prey again, but also like a dog that once more finds his master. He saw two roads before him, both equally straight, but he saw two of them, and this terrified him, for he had never in his life known more than one straight line. And what made the anguish more poignant was that the two roads were radically opposed. One of the two straight lines ruled out the other. Which of the two was the true one? His situation was more than he could bear. To owe your life to a malefactor, to accept this debt and pay it back, to be, in spite of yourself, on a par with a fugitive from justice, and to pay him back for a good deed done by another good deed, to let him say to you, "Off you go," and to say to him in turn, "You're free," to sacrifice duty, that all-encompassing obligation, to personal motives, and to feel in those personal motives something that was also all-encompassing and perhaps superior. To betray society in order to remain true to your conscience, that all these absurd things should happen and should come and heap themselves upon him, absolutely floored him. One thing had amazed him, and that was that Jean Valjean had spared him. And one thing had petrified him, and that was that he, Javert, had spared Jean Valjean. What had he come to? He looked for himself, but could not find himself any more. What was he to do now? To hand over Jean Valjean was bad. To let Jean Valjean go free was bad. In the first case, the man of the law would fall lower than the man of the galleys. In the second, a convict would rise above the law and trample it underfoot. Both cases meant dishonor for him, Javert. Whichever course he took, there was a fall. Destiny has certain extreme overhangs that loom sheer over the abyss of the impossible, and beyond which life is no more than a free fall. Javert was standing on one of those overhangs. One of the things worrying him was being made to think. The very violence of all these contradictory emotions forced him to do so. Thinking was not something he was used to. And it was oddly painful. Thinking always involves a certain amount of inner revolt, and he was annoyed at having anything like that in him. Thinking on any subject at all outside the narrow circle of his functions would have been pointless and tiring for him no matter what. But thinking about the day that had just run its course was torture. Yet he had to look inside his conscience after such a series of shake-ups and give an account of himself. What he had just done sent a shiver down his spine. He, Javert, had seen fit to decide, contrary to all police regulations, contrary to the whole social and judicial system, contrary to the code as a whole, in favor of a release. That had suited him. He had substituted his personal concerns for public concerns. Wasn't that beyond the pale? Every time he faced this unspeakable action that he had committed head-on, he shuddered from head to toe. What could he reconcile himself to doing? There was only one resort left to him: to return swiftly to the Rue de l'Homme Armé and have Jean Valjean locked up. It was clear that this was what had to be done. He could not do it. Something barred the way to him on that side. Something. What? Could there be anything else in the world besides law courts, binding verdicts, the police, and authority? Javert was shattered. A galley slave, sacred. A convict justice could not seize. And this due to Javert. That Javert and Jean Valjean, the man made to ruthlessly mete out punishment and the man made to submit to it, that these two men, who were the two sides of the same coin known as the legal system, had come to this, to both place themselves above the law. Wasn't this terrifying? What then? Would such outrages be allowed to happen and no one be punished? Would Jean Valjean be allowed to be stronger than the entire social order, to be free, and he, Javert, continue to eat the government's bread? His thoughts gradually became unbearably black. He could also have reproached himself somewhat over the insurgent who was taken back to the Rue des Filles du Calvaire while he was at it. But he didn't think of that. The lesser fault got lost in the bigger one. Besides, the insurgent was obviously dead, and, legally, death puts an end to pursuit. Jean Valjean. That was what was weighing on his mind. Jean Valjean threw him. All the axioms that had propped up his whole life collapsed before that man. Jean Valjean's generosity toward him, Javert, devastated him. Other deeds that he remembered and that he had once dismissed as lies and acts of madness came back to him now as real facts. Monsieur Madeleine reappeared behind Jean Valjean, and the two figures merged into one. One that was to be revered. Javert felt that something awful was seeping into his soul. Admiration for a convict. Respect for a galley slave. Was that possible? He shuddered at it, yet could not shake it off. There was no point trying to fight it. He was reduced to admitting in his deepest heart the sublimeness of that poor, miserable bastard. This was monstrous. A benevolent malefactor. A compassionate convict. Gentle, helpful, clement, doing good in return for bad. Offering forgiveness in return for hate. Favoring pity over revenge, preferring to be destroyed himself to destroying his enemy, saving the one who had brought him down, kneeling at the pinnacle of virtue, closer to an angel than a man. Javert was forced to admit that this monster existed. It could not go on like this. Of course, and we must insist on this, he had not surrendered without resisting this monster, this loathsome angel, this vile hero who outraged him almost as much as he amazed him. 20 times when he was in that carriage face to face with Jean Valjean, the legal tiger in him had roared. 20 times he had been tempted to throw himself at Jean Valjean, to seize him and devour him, that is, arrest him. What could be simpler, in effect? To shout out at the first guardhouse they came to, "Here is a fugitive from justice who has returned illegally." To call the gendarmes and tell them, "This man is yours," and then be on his way. To leave the damned outcast there, forget about the rest, not get involved, not interfere in anything again. This man is forever a prisoner of the law. The law will do with him what it likes. What could be more just? Javert had told himself all that. He had tried to carry on regardless, to act, to apprehend the man, and then, as now, he had not been able to. And every time his hand had shot up convulsively toward Jean Valjean's collar, his hand had dropped again, as though under an enormous weight, and in the back of his mind, a voice, A strange voice cried out to him, "Go on, then. Hand over your savior. Then have them bring you Pontius Pilate's washbasin, and wash your claws." His thoughts then turned back to himself, and beside Jean Valjean ennobled, he saw himself, Javert, demeaned. A convict was his benefactor. And another thing, why had he allowed that man to let him live? He had every right to be killed at that barricade. He ought to have exercised that right, rallied the other insurgents to his aid against Jean Valjean, got himself shot by force. That would have been better. His supreme anguish was the evaporation of all certainty. He felt torn up by the roots, annihilated. The code was now a mere stub in his hand. He was facing scruples of an unknown kind. An emotional revelation was taking shape within him, and it was entirely distinct from assertion of the law, till then his sole measuring stick. To keep to his former honesty was no longer enough. A whole order of unexpected acts surged up and subjugated him. A whole new world appeared to his soul. Kindness accepted and returned. Devotion, misericord, leniency. The havoc wreaked on austerity by pity. Acceptance of other people, no more definitive condemnation, no more damnation. The possibility of a tear purling in the eye of the law. Some indefinable sense of justice according to God's rules that was the reverse of justice according to man. He saw in the darkness the terrifying sun of an unknown morality dawning. And he was appalled and dazzled by it, like an owl forced to gaze out of an eagle's eyes. He told himself that it was true then, that there were exceptions, that authority could be unseated, that the rules could be brought up short by a deed, that not everything was framed within the text of the code, that the unforeseen commanded obedience, that the virtue of a convict could present a snare for the virtue of a public servant, that the monstrous could be divine, that destiny set up these kinds of ambushes, and he thought with despair that even he had not been safe from a surprise. He was forced to acknowledge that goodness existed. This convict had been good, and he had just been good himself, which was unheard of. Clearly, he was becoming depraved. He found himself spineless. He horrified himself. The ideal for Javert was not to be humane, to be great, to be sublime, it was to be irreproachable. Well, he had just faltered. How had he come to this? How had all this happened? He could not have said how, not even to himself. He took his head in his two hands, but it was no good. He could not manage to explain it to himself. He had certainly always had the intention of handing Jean Valjean back over to the law, whose captive Jean Valjean was, while he, Javert, was its slave. He had not admitted to himself, for a single instant while he held him, that he was thinking of letting him go. It was, in a way, without his being aware of it, that his hand had opened and released him. All kinds of puzzling new doors began to crack open before his eyes. He put himself questions and gave himself answers, and his answers scared him. He asked himself this convict, this desperado, whom I pursued to the point of persecution, and who had me under his foot and could have taken his revenge, and who should have done every bit as much out of resentment as for his security, in granting me life, in sparing me, what did he do? His duty? No. Something more. And me, in sparing him in turn, what did I do? My duty? No. Something more. So there is something more than duty? This is where he became alarmed. His balance was out of whack. The scales tipped. One of the scale pans toppled into the abyss. The other flew off up into the heavens. And Javert was no less horrified by the one on high than by the one down below. Without in the least being what is known in the world as a Voltairian, or a philosopher, or a skeptic, being, on the contrary, instinctively respectful of the established church, he knew it only as an august fragment of the social whole. Law and order was his dogma, and was enough for him. Since he had come of age and become a public servant, he had poured just about all his religion into the police. Being, and here we use the terms without the least irony and in their most serious sense, being, as we say, a spy, the way another man is a priest. He had a superior, one Monsieur Gisquet. Till that day he had barely given a thought to that other superior, God. This new chief, God, he sensed unexpectedly, and this disturbed him. He was disoriented by this unforeseen presence. He did not know what to do with this particular superior, aware as he was that the subordinate is bound always to bow and scrape, that he must not disobey or blame or discuss, and that, in relation to a superior who throws him too much, the inferior has no other recourse than to hand in his resignation. But how do you go about handing in your resignation to God? Be that as it may, and it was always to this that he came back, one fact overruled all else for him, and that was that he had just committed a terrible offense. He had just turned a blind eye to a recidivist in breach of his ban. He had just set a galley slave free. He had just robbed the laws of a man who was theirs by rights. He had done that. He could not understand himself anymore. He was not sure he was himself. The very reasons for his action escaped him. All that was left of them was vertigo. He had lived till that moment on the sort of blind faith that engenders a due probity. That faith was leaving him. That probity was letting him down. All that he had believed was coming apart at the seams. Truths he wanted nothing to do with obsessed him inescapably. From now on he had to be another man. He was suffering the strange pangs of a conscience suddenly operated on for cataracts. He could see what he hated seeing. He felt emptied, useless, cut off from his past life, demoted, dissolved. Authority was dead in him. He had no reason to go on living. What a terrible situation. To be moved. To be granite, and to have doubts, to be the very statue of punishment, cast all of a piece in the mold of the law, and to suddenly realize that under your breast of bronze you have something absurd and unruly that almost resembles a heart. To come to this, pretending good for good, even though you have told yourself till then that this particular good was bad. To be a watchdog and lick. To be ice and melt. To be a vice and turn into a hand. To suddenly feel your fingers opening. To let go. Appalling. A human projectile, no longer knowing what path to take, and recoiling. To be obliged to admit to yourself that infallibility is not infallible, that there may be error in dogma, that the code does not have the last word, society is not perfect, authority is ambiguous and can vacillate, the immutable can crack, judges are only men, the law can be mistaken, the courts can be wrong. To see a fissure in the immense blue of the firmament. What was happening inside Javert was the diverting of a rectilinear conscience, the throwing off course of a soul, the smashing of a probity irresistibly launched straight ahead and shattering against God. Of course, this was strange, that the engine driver of order, that the mechanic of authority, mounted on the blind iron horse of the straight and narrow, could be thrown by a shaft of light, that the incommutable, the direct, the correct, the geometric, the passive, the perfect, could bend, that there was, for the locomotive, a road to Damascus. God, who is always within man and resistant, he, the true conscience, to the false, stopping the spark from going out, ordering the sunbeam to remember the sun, enjoining the soul to recognize the true absolute when faced with the fictitious absolute. Indestructible humanity, the inadmissible human heart, that splendid phenomenon, the most beautiful, perhaps, of our inner wonders. Did Javert understand it? Did Javert fathom it? Did Javert even register it? Obviously not. But the pressure of the incomprehensible, the incontestable, was so great. He felt his skull cracking open. He was more a victim of this miracle than transfigured by it. He endured it, exasperated. He only saw in all that an immense difficulty in being. It seemed to him that from that point on, his breathing would be forever labored. To have the unknown hanging over his head was not something he was used to. Until now, all that had been hanging over him had been, in his eyes, a clean, simple, limpid surface. Nothing unknown or obscure there, nothing that wasn't defined, coordinated, linked, precise, exact, circumscribed, limited, closed, completely foreseen. Authority was something flat. No falling there, no vertigo before it. Javert had never seen the unknown except down below. The irregular, the unexpected, the disorderly unlocking of chaos, the possibility of sliding into an abyss, this is what happened in lower realms to rebels, to rotters, to those poor bastards, the dregs. Now Javert was tipping over backward, and he was suddenly scared by this unheard-of apparition, an abyss up above. Hell. A person was completely demolished. A person was absolutely thrown. What could a man hold on to? What a man was convinced of was crumbling. What, the chink in society's armor could be found by some magnanimous outcast? What, an honest servant of the law could suddenly find himself caught between two crimes, the crime of letting a man get away and the crime of arresting him? All was not clear in the instructions given to the public servant by the government. Duty could have dead ends. Jesus Christ, all this was real. Was it true that a former crook, buckled under the weight of his convictions, could straighten out and end up being in the right? Was it conceivable? Were there really cases, then, where the law should back off in the face of crime transfigured and stammer its excuses? Yes, it had happened, and Javert saw him, and Javert touched him. And not only could he not deny it, but he had a hand in it. These things were real. It was abominable that real facts could wind up getting so twisted. If the facts did their duty, they would stick to being evidence in law. The facts are God-given. Was anarchy now about to descend from on high? And so, with the distortion caused by anguish and the optical illusion caused by extreme dismay, anything that might have checked and corrected his impression evaporated. And society and the human race and the whole world now looked to him to be simply hideous. And so punishment, the thing judged, the force due to legislation, the decrees of the sovereign courts, the magistracy, the government, prevention and repression, official wisdom, legal infallibility, the principle of authority, all the dogmas on which rest political and civilian security, sovereignty, justice, the logic devolving from the code, the social absolute, public truth, all that was now wreckage, rubble, chaos. Himself, Javert, the keeper of order, incorruptibility at the service of the police. The heaven-sent mastiff guarding society was defeated and floored. And on this whole ruin, there was one man left standing with a green cap on his head and a halo over his brow. This was the shattering upheaval spinning him head over heels, to which he had come. This was the terrifying vision now lodged in his soul. That this could be bearable. No. It was a violent state, if ever there was one. There were only two ways out. One was to go resolutely to Jean Valjean and to slam the jailbird back in the dungeon. The other... Javert pushed off from the parapet and, holding his head high this time, set out with firm tread for the guardhouse, indicated by a lantern at a corner of the Place du Châtelet. When he got there, he saw a police officer through the window and went in. Merely by the way they push open the guardhouse door, policemen recognize each other. Javert gave his name, showed his card to the sergeant, and sat down at the guardhouse table where a candle was burning. On the table there was also a pen, a lead inkwell, and spare paper for eventual police reports and the statements of the night patrols. This table, always completed by its straw chair, is an institution. It exists in all police stations. It is invariably adorned with a boxwood saucer full of sawdust and a little pasteboard cup full of red sealing wafers, an example of the lower official style. It is with that table that state literature begins. Javert took the pen and a sheet of paper and began to write. This is what he wrote. Some observations for the good of the service. First, I beg Monsieur le Préfet to cast his eyes on this. Second, the detainees coming from the initial hearing take their shoes off and remain barefoot on the flagstones while they are being searched. Several cough on returning to prison. This entails hospital expenses. Third, tailing is good, with relays of officers at intervals, but for important occasions there ought to be at least two officers who do not lose sight of one another, so that if for any reason an officer takes sick on the job, the other can keep watch over him and stand in for him. Fourth, it is hard to explain why the special regulations of Le Madelonnette prison ban prisoners from having a chair, even when they pay for it. Fifth, at Le Madelonnette, there are only two bars on the canteen window, which allows the woman running the canteen to let the prisoners touch her hand. Sixth, the detainees, known as barkers, that call the other detainees to the visitors' room, make the prisoner pay them 2 sous to call out their name clearly. This is theft. Seventh, for a dropped thread, 10 sous are held back from a prisoner in the weaving workshop. This is an abuse on the part of the contractor, since the cloth is just as good. Eighth, it is annoying that visitors to La Force prison have to cross the Cour des Mômes to get to the visitors' room of Sainte-Marie-l'Égyptien. Ninth, it is a fact that every day, in the prefecture courtyard, one hears gendarmes recounting the interrogations of those held by the magistrates. For a gendarme who should be beyond reproach, to repeat what he has heard in the examining magistrate's chamber amounts to serious disorderly conduct. Tenth, Madame Henri is an honest woman. Her canteen is extremely clean, but it is bad for a woman to be posted at the trapdoor leading down to solitary. This is not worthy of the conciergerie of a great civilization. Javert wrote these lines in his calmest, most correct handwriting, not leaving out a comma, and making the paper screech firmly under his pen. Below the last line he signed, Javert, Inspector First Class. At the police station of the Place du Châtelet, June 7, 1832, approximately 1 o'clock in the morning. Javert dried the fresh ink, folded the sheet of paper like a letter, sealed it, wrote on the back, Note for the Administration, left it on the table, and walked out of the station. The door with its glass panels and iron bars swung shut behind him. Once more he crossed the Place du Châtelet, diagonally, regained the quay, and went back with automatic precision to the very spot he had left a quarter of an hour earlier. He leaned there and found himself again in the same position on the same flagstone of the parapet. It was as though he had not stirred. The darkness was now pitch black. It was that deathly moment that follows midnight. A ceiling of clouds hid the stars. The sky was just a sinister density. The houses of the Cité no longer had a single light in them. No one was out walking. The streets and the quays were deserted as far as the eye could see. Notre Dame and the towers of the Palais de Justice were outlined like features of the night. A street lamp turned the rim of the quay red. The silhouettes of the bridges were distorted in the mist, one behind the other. Rain had swollen the river. The spot where Javert was leaning was, as you will recall, located right above the rapid of the Seine, right over that fearful swirling whirlwind that spirals this way, then that, like an endless screw. Javert poked his head over and looked. Everything was black. You could not make anything out. You could hear the noise of the foam, but you could not see the river. Now and then, a glimmer of light flashed in those dizzying depths, and dimly snaked along, the water having the power, on the blackest of nights, to take the light, who knows where, and turn it into a death adder. The glimmer of light vanished, and everything became indistinct again. Immensity seemed to open out there. What you had below you was not water, it was a yawning chasm. The quay wall, abrupt, confused, merging into the vapor, suddenly hidden, struck you as being a cliff of infinity. You could not see a thing, but you could feel the hostile coldness of the water and smell the staleness of the wet stones. A savage breath rose from that abyss. The swelling of the river, more guessed at than seen, the tragic whispering of the waves, the gloomy enormity of the arches of the bridge, the easily imaginable fall into that somber void, all that darkness was full of horror. Javert stood dead still for some minutes, gazing at this window on darkness. He studied the invisible with a fixedness that was like attention. The water gurgled. All of a sudden he took off his hat and placed it on the edge of the quay. A moment later, a figure appeared, tall and black, which from a distance anyone still out and about could well have taken for a phantom, standing on the parapet, leaning toward the Seine. Then it straightened up and fell straight into the darkness. There was a muted splash, and the shadow alone was in on the secret of the convulsions this obscure form made as it disappeared beneath the water. Book 5. Grandson and Grandfather. In which we once more see the tree with the zinc plaster. Some little time after the events we have just related, old Boulatruelle experienced a strong emotion. Old Boulatruelle is the Montfermeil road mender we have already caught sight of in the dark sections of this book. Boulatruelle, you may remember, was a man with many and varied troubles on his mind. He broke stones and fleeced travelers on the highway. A road worker and a robber, he had a dream. He believed in treasures buried deep in the Montfermeil forest. He hoped one day to find money in the ground at the foot of a tree. Meanwhile, he enjoyed looking for it in the pockets of those passing through. And yet for the moment he was prudently lying low. He had just had a narrow escape. He had been, as we know, picked up in the Jondrette dive along with the other bandits. Vice can be useful. It was his drunkenness that saved him. They never could clear up whether he was there as robber or robbed. The case was dismissed due to lack of evidence, based on his clearly observable state of intoxication on the night of the ambush. And he was set free. He got away to the woods again. He went back to his old road between Gagny and Lagny to carry out graveling on behalf of the state and under the surveillance of the administration, keeping his head down, a little downcast, extremely pensive and with slightly cold feet as far as robbery went, since that activity had nearly sunk him, but turning all the more tenderly to drink, which had just saved his neck. As for the strong emotion he experienced shortly after being back under the turf roof of his roadmender's hut again, this was it. One morning, shortly before daybreak, as he was making his way as usual to his work, and perhaps to his hideout, Boulatruelle spotted a man among the branches, and though he could only see his back, the man's bulk, it seemed to him, from a distance, through the dim light, was not entirely unfamiliar to him. Boulatruelle may have been a drunk, but his memory was intact and lucid, an indispensable defensive weapon when a man is somewhat at odds with the legal order.
Where the devil have I seen that man before?
He asked himself. But he could not provide himself with an answer, except that he looked like someone who had left a dim trace in his mind. Nonetheless, apart from the man's identity, which he could not quite put his finger on, Boulatruelle made some connections and calculations. The man was not from around there. He had come there from somewhere else. On foot, obviously. No public conveyance passes at that hour at Montfermeil. He had walked all night. Where had he come from? From somewhere not far away. For he had neither a haversack nor a bundle. From Paris, no doubt. Why was he in this wood? Why was he there at such an hour? What had he come there to do? Boulatruelle thought about the treasure. By dint of digging into his memory, he vaguely remembered having had a similar jolt already several years before in relation to a man who struck him as very possibly the same man. While he chewed this over, he had, under the very weight of his meditation, bowed his head, which is only natural but not too clever. When he looked up again, there was no one in sight. The man had melted into the forest and into the gloom.
"Bugger," said Boulatruelle. "I'll find him again, but I'll find out which parish this particular parishioner hails from. This stroller up at the crack of dawn has a why and a wherefore, and I'll find out what it is. There are no secrets in my woods without me sticking my nose in."
He grabbed his pickaxe, which was very sharp.
"Now this," he muttered, "is just the thing for ploughing through dirt, or a man."
And following the path the man must have taken as exactly as he could, the way you tie one thread to another thread, he set off through the undergrowth. When he had gone 100 yards, day was starting to break and came to his aid. Footprints left in the sand here and there, grass flattened underfoot, ferns crushed, young branches bent back in the scrub and straightening out again at a graciously slow pace, like the arms of a pretty woman stretching out on waking, more or less pointed the way. He followed it, then he lost it. Time passed, he delved further into the woods, and came to a kind of knoll. An early morning hunter going by, along a path in the distance, whistling jauntily, gave him the idea of climbing up a tree. Though old, he was agile. There was a very tall beech tree nearby, worthy of Virgil's Tityrus, and of Boulatruelle. Boulatruelle climbed the beech as high as he could. It was a good idea. Exploring the lonely expanse over where the wood is completely tangled and wild, Boulatruelle suddenly spotted his man. Hardly had he spotted him when he lost sight of him again. The man went, or rather, slipped into a fairly remote glade, camouflaged by tall trees, a place Boulatruelle knew well, though, having noticed, near a big pile of millstones, a sick chestnut tree bandaged with a zinc plaster nailed straight onto the bark. This glade is the clearing known as the Blaru grounds in days gone by. The pile of stones that could be seen there 30 years ago, intended for who knows what use, is doubtless still there today. Nothing can beat a pile of stones for longevity, unless it is a paling fence. It is always only temporary. What a good reason for it to stay where it is. Boulatruelle, going hell for leather in his excitement, practically fell out of the tree climbing down. The lair had been found. Now it was just a matter of bagging the game. The famous treasure of his dreams was probably there. It was no mean feat getting to the glade. The well-trodden paths that zigzag crazily all over the place took a good quarter of an hour. The straight path through the thicket, which is incredibly thick, extremely thorny, and extremely aggressive, took a good half an hour. Boulatruelle made the mistake of not reckoning on this. He believed in the straight line, a respectable optical illusion, but one that causes a lot of people to come unstuck. The thicket, spiky as it was, seemed to him to be the right way. "We'll take the wolves Rue de Rivoli," he said. Boulatruelle was used to straying. This time, he made the mistake of going straight. He threw himself with gusto into the melee of the undergrowth. He had to tackle holly, nettles, hawthorn, dog roses, thistles, the crankiest of brambles, and got himself scratched to bits. At the bottom of a ravine, he found water that he had to wade through. He finally reached the Blaru glade after a good 40 minutes, sweating, soaked, out of breath, clawed to bits, ferocious. No one in the glade. Boulatruelle ran to the pile of stones. It was in place. It had not been carted away. As for the man, he had vanished into the forest. He had escaped. Where to? Which way? In what thicket? Impossible to guess. And, most poignantly, behind the pile of stones, in front of the tree with the zinc plaster, there was freshly dug dirt, a forgotten or abandoned pick, and a hole. The hole was empty.
Thief!
Cried Boulatruelle, showing the horizon his two fists. Marius, emerging from civil war, gears up for domestic war. For a long while, Marius was neither dead nor alive. For several weeks he had a fever accompanied by delirium and serious symptoms of brain damage, caused more by the concussion resulting from the wounds to the head than by the wounds themselves. He repeated Cosette's name for whole nights on end in the morbid loquacity induced by fever and with the grim obstinacy of approaching death. The size of certain injuries was a serious danger, pus suppurating from open wounds always being susceptible to being resorbed and consequently killing the patient under certain atmospheric conditions. At every change in the weather, at the least storm, the doctor became anxious. "Above all else, don't excite him," he would repeat. The bandages were complex and difficult, for fixing pads and cloth in place with surgical tape or sticking plaster had not yet been dreamed up at the time. Nicolette used up a sheet as big as a ceiling, she said, for lint. It was not without a struggle that the chlorinated lotions and the silver nitrate finally got the better of the gangrene. As long as there was danger, Monsieur Gillenormand stayed by his grandson's bedside, distraught, and, like Marius, neither dead nor alive. Every day and sometimes twice a day, a white-haired gentleman, very well dressed according to the description provided by the porter, came to hear the latest on the wounded man, and left a fat packet of lint for bandages. At last, on September 7th, 3 months to the day from the painful night he was brought back dying to his grandfather's home, the doctor declared that he was out of danger. Convalescence began. Marius, though, had to stay lying down on a chaise longue for over 2 months still, on account of the complications produced by the fractured collarbone. There is always one last wound that does not want to heal and so prolongs the bandaging to the great annoyance of the patient. On the other hand, this long illness and convalescence saved him from prosecution. In France, there is no rage, not even official rage, that 6 months won't snuff out. Riots, in the current state of society, are so much everybody's fault that they are followed by a certain need to turn a blind eye. We might add that the unspeakable directive issued by Gisquet enjoining doctors to denounce the wounded, having outraged public opinion, and not only public opinion but the king first and foremost, the wounded were shielded and protected by this outrage, and, with the exception of those who had been taken prisoner in actual combat, the courts martial did not dare disturb any of them. And so they left Marius in peace. Monsieur Gillenormand went through every possible anguish at first, and after that, every possible ecstasy. They had a lot of trouble preventing him from spending every night by the wounded man's side. He had his great big armchair wheeled in next to Marius's bed. He demanded that his daughter use the best linen in the house to make poultices and bandages with. Mademoiselle Gillenormand, wise elder daughter that she was, managed to find a way of sparing the very best linen while letting the old man think his wishes were respected. Monsieur Gillenormand would not allow anyone to explain to him that, for making lint, cambric is not as good as coarse cloth, and new cloth is not as good as used cloth. He watched all the dressing operations while Mademoiselle Gillenormand absented herself for modesty's sake. When they hacked away the dead flesh with scissors, he would wince, "Ouch! Ouch!" Nothing could be more touching than to see him handing the patient a cup of herbal tea with his slight, senile tremor. He overwhelmed the doctor with questions without realizing that his questions were always the same ones. The day the doctor told him that Marius was out of danger, the poor man went delirious. He gave his porter 3 louis as a bonus. That evening, when he went up to his room, he danced a gavotte, clicking his thumb and index finger like castanets, and he sang the following song. Jeanne was born in Fougères, a real nest for a shepherdess. I love her petticoat, little rogue. Love, you live in her, for it is in her eyes that you put your quiver. Scoffer. Me, I sing of her, and love more than Diana, even Jeanne and her hard Breton nipples. Then he knelt on a chair, and Basque, who watched him through the door, which was ajar, felt sure he prayed. Until then, he hadn't believed in God for a moment. At each new stage of improvement, as recovery became more and more marked, the old man ranted and raved. He did all sorts of wildly gay things, quite unconsciously. He ran up and down the stairs without knowing why. A neighbor, and a pretty one at that, was quite stunned one morning to receive a huge bouquet. It was Monsieur Gillenormand who had sent it. The husband threw a jealous fit. Monsieur Gillenormand tried to pull Nicolette onto his knees. He called Marius Monsieur le Baron. He cried out, "Long live the Republic!" At every turn he asked the doctor, "There's no danger anymore, is there?" He would look at Marius with a grandmother's gaze. He would sit and brood over him as he ate. He did not know himself anymore. He no longer counted. Marius was the master of the house. There was abdication in the old man's joy. He was his grandson's grandson. In the state of delight he was in, he was the most venerable of children. From fear of tiring or annoying the convalescent, he would stand behind him and beam down at him. He was happy, joyful, thrilled, charming, young. His white hair added sweet majesty to the shiny bright light that lay over his face. When grace tackles wrinkles, it is adorable. There is an indefinable dawning in radiant old age. As for Marius, while letting himself be bandaged and cared for, he had only one idea in his head. Cosette. Since the fever and delirium had left him, he no longer uttered that name, and a person could be forgiven for thinking that he no longer thought about her. He kept his mouth shut, precisely because his heart would have leaped out of it. He did not know what had become of Cosette. The whole business of the Rue de la Chanvrerie was like a cloud in his memory. Almost indistinct shadows flitted through his mind. Éponine, Gavroche, Mabeuf, the Thénardiers, all his friends grimly mixed up with the smoke of the barricade. The strange cameo role of Monsieur Fauchelevent in that gory episode struck him as a riddle in a tempest. He did not understand a thing about his own life. He did not know how or through whom he had been saved, and no one around him knew either. All they had been able to tell him was that he had been brought back to the Rue des Filles du Calvaire at night in a fiacre. Past, present, future, everything inside him was now no more than the fog of a vague idea. But in this mist there was one fixed point, a clear and precise outline, something carved in stone, a resolution, a desire, to find Cosette again. For him, the idea of life itself could not be separated from the idea of Cosette. He had decreed in his heart that he would not accept one without the other, and he was unshakably determined to demand of anyone or anything that wanted to force him to live, whoever and whatever they might be, his grandfather, fate, hell, the restitution of his lost Eden. He did not hide the obstacles from himself. We might underline one detail here. He was not won over or much softened by all the tender, loving care his grandfather showed him. In the first place, he was not entirely aware of its extent. Then, in his sick man's daydreams, which were perhaps still feverish, he mistrusted sweetness of the sort as something new and strange aimed at bringing him to heal. He remained coldly unmoved by it. The grandfather smiled his poor old smile for nothing. Marius said to himself that, yes, everything was all right, as long as he, Marius, did not say anything, and went along with things. But that as soon as Cosette came up, he would see a different face, and that his grandfather's true feelings would then betray themselves. The gloves would be off then. Just watch the old family issues rear their ugly head again, and the clash between their positions, and every sarcastic remark, and every objection all at once. Fauchelevent, Coupe-le-Vent, wealth, poverty, destitution, the old millstone around the neck, the future. Violent resistance. Conclusion, refusal. Marius was steeling himself in advance. And then the more he recovered, the more his old grievances crept up on him, the more the old ulcers of his memory reopened, he thought once more about the past. Colonel Pontmercy once more came between Monsieur Gillenormand and himself. Marius, he told himself, there was no real kindness to hope for from someone who had been so unjust and so hard on his father. And with health, a kind of bitter harshness toward his grandfather returned. The old man quietly took it on the chin and suffered in silence. Monsieur Gillenormand noticed that since he had been brought home to him and since he had regained consciousness, Marius had not once called him father. Though he did not show that he noticed this, Marius did not call him monsieur, true, but he found a way of saying neither one nor the other by using a certain manner of circumlocution. A crisis was obviously brewing. As almost always happens in such cases, Marius, to try his hand, skirmished before giving battle. This is known as seeing how the land lies. One morning it so happened that Monsieur Gillenormand, over a newspaper that had fallen into his hands, spoke lightly of the convention and let fall a casual royalist remark about Danton, Saint-Just, and Robespierre. "The men of 93 were giants," said Marius sternly. The old man shut up and did not breathe a whisper for the rest of the day. Marius had always had in his mind's eye the inflexible grandfather of his early years, and so he saw this silence as a profound concentration of anger and foresaw from it a fierce struggle, and he stepped up his preparations for battle in the innermost recesses of his mind. He decided that if his grandfather refused, he would rip off his bandages, dislocate his collarbone, expose and open whatever wounds he still had, and push away all food. His wounds were his ammunition. He would have Cosette or die. He waited for the right moment with the sly patience of the sick. That moment arrived. Marius attacks. One day, while his daughter was tidying up the cups and vials on the marble top of the chest of drawers, Monsieur Gillenormand leaned over Marius and said to him, in the most loving tone, "You see, my darling Marius, if I were you, I'd be eating meat now rather than fish. Fried sole is excellent at the start of convalescence, but to get a sick man on his feet, there's nothing like a good chop." Marius, who had regained almost all his strength, gathered it together, sat up, drove his bald fists into the bedclothes, looked his grandfather straight in the eye as fiercely as he could, and said, "That brings me to something I want to say to you."
"Which is?"
"That I wish to marry."
"It's all taken care of,"
said the grandfather, and he burst out laughing. "What do you mean, it's all taken care of?"
"Yes, it's all taken care of. You shall have her, your little lass."
Marius, stunned and overcome with dizziness, trembled in every limb. Monsieur Gillenormand went on.
"Yes, you shall have her. Your beautiful, pretty little girl, she comes every day in the form of an old gentleman to hear your latest news. Since you were wounded, she has passed her time weeping and making lint. I made inquiries. She lives in the Rue de l'Homme Armé, No. 7. So at last, the truth's out. You want her? Well, then, you shall have her. That's got you." "You devised your little plot. You said to yourself, 'I'm going to come right out with it to this grandfather of mine, this embalmed mummy of the Regency and the Directoire, this has-been of an old rake, this Dorant who's turned into Géronte. He's had his lighter moments, too, he has, and his love affairs, and his grisettes, and his cosettes. He's strutted around in his finery like a peacock. He's spread his wings. He's sown his wild oats. Surely he must remember what it was like. We'll soon see. Let the battle begin. So, you take the bull by the horns. That's good. I offer you a chop, and you answer, 'By the way, I wish to marry.' Now, that's what I call a leap. Ah, you were all set on a bit of a tiff. You didn't know I was an old coward. What have you got to say about that? You're nettled. You didn't expect to find your grandfather even more of a fool than you are, did you? You're losing the thread of the speech you were going to make me, Monsieur the Attorney. That's irritating. Well, then, too bad. Rant away. I'm doing